All right, so this week, Hume's frontal assault on Christianity, and then next week, the closing week of this semester, will be Hume's foundational assault on Christianity. And so all I'm shooting for there is these are the more obvious, big picture ways in which Hume attempted to be a skeptic of supernatural revealed religion. But then there have been, many people who think that Hume got a bad rap. And so I'm going to deal with that a little bit today, but then next week we're going to see how what Hume was attacking, even if we accept the most optimistic picture of what Hume meant, still what you're going to have is a foundational assault on Christianity in his argument against natural theology. So today, his frontal assault on Christianity. Let me give you one example of this optimistic picture of Hume, or charitable interpretation. The 20th century conservative historian, who I like a lot, Russell Kirk, was very charitable to Hume in seeing the majority of his work as friendly to faith and skeptical only of reason. And so he has in his sights rationalism. Much like John Locke did, his opponent was the rationalists. By extension, attack the medieval schoolmen when they are, quote, rationalistic. But that's the idea. And you'll see that. Hume is lumped in as a conservative. He doesn't strike you as a liberal in his view of history and politics. He strikes you as a conservative. And so these conservative scholars in the last 100 years see his philosophical project as pretty much doing the thing. So he's friendly to faith, he's skeptical only of reason. So reasoned presentations of the faith, whether that's in the form of apologetics or systematic theology, in other words, dogma or speculation. And it's kind of interesting because when you look at it that way, you may still have to argue against Hume, but you may see a lot of modern and postmodern forms of Christianity in Hume. And that's what's interesting, I think. So in this theory, it was the metaphysical supernaturalism of the medieval schoolmen. Not even so much that Christianity was supernatural, that God was God, and that there are supernatural things going on, but it was this metaphysical speculative supernaturalism of the medieval world, or the confident claims of modern enthusiasts, and Hume would probably lump Puritans into those guys. In other words, it was any Christianity which was rigidly dogmatic. That's the idea. Any Christianity that said, hey, I know what I'm talking about and this stands over you too. That's what Hume meant to assault. It was not historic Christianity per se. Even Benjamin Franklin is quoted as calling his Scottish friend, quote, a good Christian. Well, we can imagine Hume's argument against dogmatism strictly as being against church dogma, capital C, so the Roman Catholic dogma. We can imagine his argument against miracles as being against the constant barrage of Catholic claims down to the present. You know how everybody gets authority in the Catholic Church by producing some miracle in the present day. Maybe that was his argument. We can imagine his argument for the necessity of liberty, in other words, free will, to be an assault against a straw man version of Calvinism that he received from his own little Scottish enclave, because they're pretty reformed up there. And you can certainly imagine all of that into Hume's arguments. But I think there's plenty of evidence against Kirk's rosy thesis of David Hume. But the truth is as simple as this. The conservatives who were not Catholics in the 20th century were at least old school Anglicans. So I smell a motive. Anglicans who would have embraced a David Hume that cut down the flanking dogmas of Rome and the Reformation, because that's what Anglicanism always did. And that should give us a pause to think of how much the anti-dogmatic majority of modern evangelicalism has in common with the infamous skeptic of the Enlightenment. As you read this today, if you're not particularly interested in the apologetics worldview issues, at least have your antennas up for this. Notice how many times you think to yourself as you hear Hume assault what we would recognize to be Christianity, think how many times you will have to say to yourself, I've heard that before from the church. I've heard that before in emerging books, but you know what? I've heard that before in books that we would not normally recognize as emergent church-type arguments. So that's the outline today. Number one, Hume against dogma. Number two, against unnatural freedom. That's just what I'm going to call it. Number three, against miracles. And number four, against providence. So first, briefly, against dogma. By way of summary, Hume says this in his inquiry concerning human understanding. He says, we have no idea of the supreme being but what we learn from reflection on our own faculties. That's interesting. Remember, he's an empiricist. He's going to say it a different way later. He's going to say, we have no idea of God but what we derive from experience. But remember, experience had two components in Locke: sensation and reflection. Reflection being on the operations of our own mind. Now, we remember that Hume is going to build when he gets to this thing called an idea. What does an idea come from? Sensation is one road in. The other road in was passion from in here. So we already did that. But it's interesting that right now, he's going to focus on this inward part of experience. That's where we derive the idea of God. So you can imagine, to borrow and mix metaphors, Plato's cave where that fire is going, and the puppet masters are projecting from that fire, their little hand puppets or whatever they use, these shadows on the wall. And so what Hume's saying here is going to show up again in Ludwig Feuerbach in the 19th century, and then later in the 19th century, Sigmund Freud. In other words, this action that's happening here we can call projection. We can call it a wish projection, or we can call it a fear projection, or any number of passions that we have. We collect these things about ourselves, we reflect on our own faculties, and we derive our idea of God by just taking those things to the nth degree. So no, Feuerbach and no, Freud were not original in that idea. David Hume was already suggesting that. And so notice, if you're going to have a view of Hume that's charitable, notice that he is already restricting religious knowledge to what we can know about this world and about ourselves. Now, it's interesting that in his letter to a friend in Edinburgh, defending himself so that he can get in their university, he lumps into all the people that he disagrees with, Arians, Socinians. Come on, I'm not one of them, and I'm not one of these deists. And he puts deist on that list. And you know, when you're so involved in self-deception, you can actually, I mean, come on, anybody that reads Hume, to say that he's a deist is an understatement. He's the deist of all deists. He's the smartest of the deists in that sense. He's restricting religious knowledge to two things: what we can know about this world outside of us, what we can know about this moral law inside of us. Well, that is deism. But to oppose the dogma, which forms our claim to know, just is to oppose the whole of the faith. You could say, well, Hume's not attacking Christianity in the sense that it's supernatural and that it takes faith. He's opposing the metaphysical speculations of these people in the last two, three, four centuries before him. But to oppose the dogma which claims to know, that's his enemy. That is to oppose Christianity. That is to oppose revealed religion. The best that could be said, perhaps, was that Hume was also skeptical of dogmatic skepticism. So not just dogmatic revelation, but also dogmatic skepticism. Still leaving open the possibility that God was the great power behind even our empirically derived experience. So he has the same setup as Locke, except, you know, with a vengeance. But even behind that, there is God. And you see that in the Roman Catholic idea, strangely enough, because Hume is attacking a lot of Roman Catholic ideas. But this separation between revelation and reason, revelation up there, reason down here, and there's still a place for the supernatural stuff, but that's in here. That's this, whatever faith is, and however we connect to that. And that's how Hume's going to lead into Kant. But you could say this, you could say all of these things about Hume and be charitable. And this would essentially be John Locke minus any historically conceived doctrine, because Locke still had a place for the Christian doctrine, like the resurrection and stuff like that. He would defend that. But even if we express things like this, there is nothing left of actual Christianity. And I would say that anybody that doesn't see that about Hume is not much of a theologian. So I have respect for Russell Kirk as a historian, but as a theologian, I think this is why some of these things are going to matter. One clue as to Hume's wedge into supernatural Christianity comes through the voice of that guy, Demia. Remember, we introduced last week the dialogues concerning natural religion. And there was these three guys, Philo, who was pretty much articulating Hume's skepticism. You had Cleanthes, who was the religious rationalist. And you had Demia, who was the religious irrationalist. So he represents most Christians in the last 200-300 years after Hume. But in the voice of Demia, in the dialogues, he distinguishes his faith from Cleanthes' rationalistic speculation. Demia says this: the question is not concerning the being, but the nature of God. So in other words, we don't disagree that there is a God. We disagree about whether or not we can know what he's like. So the question is not concerning the being of God, but the nature of God. He says, this I affirm from the infirmities of human understanding to be altogether incomprehensible and unknown to us. So stop right there. From the time of the essay to the dialogues, either Hume moves from atheism to agnosticism, that's one possibility, or he always was an atheist and he's softballing through these other characters, or he always was an agnostic and never was an atheist. To which I respond, I don't care what Hume personally, I am not my skeptical philosopher who's been dead for 250 years keeper. I am my brother's keeper, but I won't be Hume's keeper because he's dead and I can't really do anything for him. So I don't care. Okay, that's not our question. Our question is, where do these ideas come from? What do they lead to? What do they actually represent? So Demia is saying, the question is not the being of God, but the essence of God. The what he is. Not that he is. That he is, I'm going to assume that. But what he is, above this line. Now remember this scoreboard, because this is the scoreboard that Kant is going to fill out. You could say, Hume was the real big player in the Enlightenment. He blows everything apart. Kant systematizes the debris. Okay, that's one way to say it. And we'll do Kant next semester. But let's start with this. Demia is very much at this point speaking for Hume. Hume is spoken for by Philo in the main. But at this point, Demia is speaking for Hume. Hume is trying to say, I'm not an atheist. I'm not an irreligionist. But I'm against religious rationalism. I don't disagree that God exists. I'm saying we can't know what he is from the things that we have available to us. So Hume says, this is because, now he's going to tell you why he says this. Quote, our ideas reach no farther than our experience. So he's still in Locke land. We have no experience of divine attributes and operations. End quote. So, below the line, let us put the word experience. Locke would approve. Hume is taking that ball. Now, at the top of the stairs, Schaefer staircase, experience, as Hume means it, has been absolutely discredited. But I'm not going to talk to them anymore. I'm going to talk to the unsuspecting 18-year-old, as Rush Limbaugh once called them, skulls full of mush. And down here at that part of the stairs, I'm going to ignore what happened at the top of the stairs because they'll never understand it anyway. And so I don't really have to tell them. And so we're just going to assume this word experience because to them that'll sound like a tough-minded idea. We could see that. Where's your God? Show me. Okay? So, Let's leave that up there. That's the framework. We have no experience of divine attributes. We have no experience of divine operations. And so there is something unnatural to speculative dogma. Now, at this point, Hume is going to give you his little history of religion. Now, there's another book that he writes where he really draws this out. So again, not only is Freud not original, Julian Fellhausen is not original either. The idea of the history of religions, Hume talked about that as well. There's something unnatural about a rationalistic religion. There's something unnatural about a religion that has to prove itself. There's something unnatural about a religion that has to write systematic big books explaining what we should all know. If God is so fair, God is simple. And this big book, that excludes, there's something unnatural about that. This can be seen in the primitive ages of religion when belief arose naturally out of primal fears and tribal stories. Hume's not making fun of that. Hume's saying at least that's more natural. And from there you had cultic practices. But it is when religion is desperate to hang on that it unnaturally spins itself in a web of its own defense. And so Hume is saying that what's unnatural is speculative religion, wordy religion. All these verbal attempts to avoid the obvious that we don't really know. The impression is given that Hume would have been all right with the sort of simple faith of everybody's forefathers. There's Hume's conservatism. But Hume's natural religion is also a mass of contradictions. For just one example, he claims matter-of-factly that, quote, all perfection is entirely relative. But do you remember last week? That he rests his problem of evil on what a perfect being would do to stop it? All perfection is entirely relative now. Well, just last week, when he wanted us to consider evil, the reason that we should discount God because evil exists is that a perfect being would do such and such. But now he's going to say out of the other side of his mouth that all perfections are entirely relative. So Hume is a mass of contradictions. Hume is the king of contradictions. Hume has more fallacies attached. Hume has more fallacies spewing out of his mouth than there are fallacies in the fallacy detective textbook. There actually aren't enough pages in a fallacy textbook that I'm aware of to keep track of all the fallacies Hume is spewing out. All right, well, Hume launches out against what I'm going to call unnatural freedom. And it looks at first like he's beginning to give us a solution to that perennial free will versus determinism debate. He's actually not. What Hume is doing here is he's giving us a defense of morality. Because he's pretty convinced that speculative religion is actually a danger to morality. And I'll explain why that is in just a little bit. But he starts out with this definition. Quote, by liberty, or by free will, freedom of choice, we can only mean a power of acting or not acting according to the determinations of the will. That is, if we choose to remain at rest, we may. If we choose to move, we also may. Stop. Hume's about to say something good in a second, but right there, he falls infinitely short of what Edwards says. He's going to agree with Edwards at one point, just a second. But right here, let me read this again. Remember, now I'm cheating and I'm allowing you to cheat. I'm telling you ahead of time, what he's doing is actually providing a defense of morality. He's going to say, if we don't have this idea of freedom, morality goes down the tubes, and here's why. But just listen to this definition one more time and see if you can find the problem with this idea of the will. And just think of what's wrong with Arminianism and what Edwards was arguing against in the freedom of the will. By liberty, we can only mean a power of acting or not acting according to the determinations of the will. That is, if we choose to remain at rest, we may. If we choose to move, we also may. End quote. Now, if by rest he means I choose to sit on the couch and play video games, is that something or nothing? It's still something. No, I choose to remain in I am undecided on the God question. Are you? Is the decision to not make a decision also a decision? I think it is. The will is acting either way. He says the power of acting or not acting. The power of not acting? The power of not acting. Really? The power of not acting? Again, I must challenge you, atheist out there. This is your best guy? The power of not acting? Really? analyze that for a second, and just take a while. Write me an email when you get it, but just keep saying it to yourself until the pennies drop. Okay, so a choice is by definition an effect. Here's where he's going to say something right, and this is going to help us. A choice is by definition an effect, and therefore it requires a cause. So, he says, it is pretended that some causes are necessary, some not necessary. Now he's going to do something good. He's actually going to challenge the idea, so he's going to be a little bit more sophisticated than Arminianism and modern humanistic theology, but still nowhere near Edwards. What he's going to do is he's going to challenge the idea that necessity means the opposite of freedom. He's like, there's two kinds of necessity. You could mean it to mean the logical word, namely, that such and such must be the case. In other words, A equals A. But you could mean by something must be the case some form of coercion. It's necessarily this, therefore, couldn't be otherwise. So this is with respect to freedom. Okay? So it's kind of an implication of it if you're looking at that secondary thing. It's not the general definition of necessity. So that's good. He says, it is pretended that some causes are necessary, some not necessary. Now, if this definition is admitted, he concludes, quote, liberty when opposed to necessity, not to constraint, liberty when opposed to necessity, not to constraint, is the same thing as chance, which is universally allowed to have no existence. So Hume is saying, chance is not a thing. It can't do anything, it's just a mathematical word. And so if we mean necessity purely and simply as the opposite of freedom, then what we mean by freedom is simply chance. In other words, we don't really mean anything. Well, that's great, that's awesome, that's better than most modern people have meant by this. Okay, but what is he driving at? Here's what he's driving at. He immediately takes it back. Therefore, if all necessary causes are known, say for example by God, or if, in principle, all causes are known to be necessary per se, in other words, what he hears in the idea of omniscience is this same confusion that people make. If God knows with necessity everything that's going to happen, therefore, and so you're going to have the same mistake as the middle knowledge people make, you're going to confuse divine foreknowledge, which is already subject to misinterpretation, and divine foreordination, that God knowing is what causes something to happen. So, if he knows what you're going to do, therefore, you have no liberty. And so, here's what Hume's doing. Hume attacks not so much the freedom of the will as many atheists have done. That's a whole different debate. But he attacks the assumption that the omniscience of God and the freedom of the will could coexist. So like his problem of evil, this is another instance of a God versus world atheology. So in other words, let's put above the line omniscience and put below the line freedom. In other words, freedom of the will. So just like you would put in the problem of evil down here, and then that trio of things, wisdom, all power, all goodness, those are incompatible. So it's God versus world atheology. Even so, he says, quote, the doctrines both of necessity and of liberty are not only consistent with morality, but are absolutely essential to its support. So he's going to try to give them a particular flavor that's going to show how this is a foundation of morality and how this actually endangers morality. So, in other words, here's the upshot. Classical theism, as expressed in dogma, as expressed in speculation, actually endangers morality, undercuts morality. That's his argument. Necessity, per se, which he thinks he's defending, which, again, he attacked when it came to the pool room, remember, and the cue ball heading into the eight ball. Now he's going to be its great defender. Necessity is necessary for maintaining abiding standards of justice and crime and punishment. You can't know what it is, but you have to assume that it is. So everything Kant is going to say, Hume is kind of already suggesting. You can't know what it is, namely the necessary connection, but you have to assume it, in this case, for morality. So Hume is going to continue to talk, even though all the things that are coming out of Hume's mouth, Hume has told you, we can't really know what those things are. But that they exist is necessary to get on in life. Okay, so pragmatic argument. Necessity is necessary for maintaining standards of justice in crime and punishment. But just as much, nothing could be called either praiseworthy or blameworthy that someone could not have done otherwise. So here's a negative reason why this dogmatic scheme eliminates or undercuts morality. Because you can't call something praiseworthy or blameworthy that somebody could not have done otherwise. If it just had to happen, then that's like praising good rock there for not going through that window. You wouldn't do that because a rock couldn't do otherwise unless projected that way. But if you did project a rock that way, you wouldn't go up to the rock and say, what did you do? You would go up to the person that threw it, right? And because you couldn't have done otherwise. Okay, so we attach virtue to that good which was done willingly, and we attach vice to that evil which was done just as willingly. So while Hume is on the subject, very clever, he injects a little half a paragraph on the unsuspecting reader. This is why I go through with highlighters, so I'm less of an unsuspecting reader. Okay? So while he's on this subject, Hume draws an analogy between the vice that we attach to the man who plants a landmine, whether the terrible consequences follow immediately or much later. So a man who plants a landmine, on the one hand, and the intelligence which planted the world, packed with all the explosives of evil, whether they detonate all at once or whether they explode on us later. We would call, if we call the first person wicked for planting a mine, even though after wartime it could explode on a child, wouldn't we find it just as blameworthy to blame an intelligence which planted the world packed with all the explosives of evil? Now this is about two or three sentences. In other words, this is kind of a landmine of Hume's own. Far enough away from his main treatment of the problem of evil that it may unexpectedly detonate upon the mind of readers who are sufficiently distracted by already attending to the argument about the will. Hume is making a detailed argument about the will and what you need for moral action to take its course. In the process of it, he plants this landmine, these two or three sentences, this subliminal message, in the same way, you know, for example, very, very clever. Very clever. He brings back in an emotional analogy about the problem of evil in the middle of his discussion about the will. And so I put it in there, so if you're listening to this and you read Hume, you won't have that detonate on you unexpectedly, because we've already discredited that. All of this is a pragmatic argument for objective morality, but Hume also offers an epistemic argument for objective morality. And it's the very same as his whole approach to history and politics. Moral behavior is a posteriori, confirmed by experience. We know morality. We know what is right and wrong. Wait a minute, we can't know what? We can't know the goodness of God. We can't know, all we have is experience to go on. I know. But we can know what is right and wrong based on the long-standingness of a particular right or a particular wrong. So what? Countries begin by force, not by universal consent. We can't say that anything's good all at once, but by long accepted approbation and condemnation, we can know public right from wrong as well as private right from wrong. In other words, by our experience, over a long period of time, something can be seen to be better or worse than another thing. So this kind of forms Hume's politics, and it forms a lot of conservative politics, this emphasis on what is long-standing, the common law tradition in the English-speaking world, which I'm all for, as argued by guys like William Blackstone, arguing at the same time as Hume. But what I'm not for is saying that that is the ground of right and wrong. Because what if a country got everything wrong all the way back? What if it was just a savage nation all the way to the beginning? It's interesting, by the way, that Rousseau actually came to stay in the home of Hume for a time, until the paranoid Frenchman fled. In reality, those two men's conceptions of social justice were light years apart. There was no social compact as far as Hume was concerned, but rather, civil law emerges, justice in society emerges, by the accumulation of moral and legal custom. So, same thing, remember? So there's no cause and effect in the sense that we can understand the necessary connection of particular causes and particular effects. The reason we have science, the reason we have these things, is by custom, over time. Well, guess what? His politics are the same way. We cannot really say that this is right and this is wrong in the sense that we just heard from the eternal lawgiver, but by custom, over time, we can derive these things. A lot of political historians would say that Adam Smith and Jeremy Bentham and others were directly influenced by Hume and his a posteriori emphasis in their theories of economics with Smith and civil law in Bentham's case. Again, these guys weren't influenced directly by Hume, but guys like Montesquieu and Blackstone and Edmund Burke in the same century, at least on this particular point, were saying the same thing that David Hume was. So if you're ever wondering, why is David Hume lumped together with these giants of political conservatism, it's because of his emphasis on custom and experience. In other words, against nine black-robed sophisticates 2,000 miles away telling us how far we've progressed by their own a priori wisdom that they have all at once. Instead, wisdom is to be found in the long-standing, long-accumulated custom of a people. And so at that point, Hume was, in that one respect, Hume was a conservative. All right, now we're going to get juicy. Hume against miracles. The evidence for supernatural Christianity is, according to Hume, less than the evidence for the truth of our senses. So if you want to get it on a 101 level, this is Hume's big idea. The evidence for supernatural Christianity is less than the evidence for the truth of our senses. For two reasons. Number one, the supernatural is less evidential than the natural, even for the alleged eyewitnesses. But secondly, such evidence diminishes even further over time as one moves away from the alleged eyewitnesses. So, the kind of thing that a miracle is less evidential, i.e. less empirical, even for the eyewitnesses. But then secondly, as you move away from that time, that evidence diminishes even further. In section 10 of the inquiry, called On Miracles, Hume begins with the occasion of the real presence in the Eucharist. Possibly, two possible explanations for this, possibly to elicit anti-Catholic sympathy for his more general skepticism. In other words, he's going to make a general skeptical argument against miracles, but he's going to start out by saying, you know, like those superstitious Catholics do. And so what he's doing there is he's rousing up anti-Catholic sentiment that already exists to turn them into agnostics. There's another possibility, and that's Russell Kirk's thesis, that something like that is actually an attack against that kind of superstitious religion, and that Hume never meant to make us fully skeptical of religion per se. But I've already showed you in Hume's deism, there's no place for the resurrection. So, that's just not the likeliest interpretation of Hume's strategy here. But even here, Hume is going to lay down a principle which will lead to his undoing. He says, quote, "A weaker evidence can never destroy a stronger." A weaker evidence can never destroy a stronger. Pretty uncontroversial principle. Now, the Christian reader may think to respond, wait a minute, our belief in the miracle of the resurrection is not a disbelief in the daily occurrence of water expanding when frozen. What do you mean a weaker evidence is no argument against or cannot destroy a stronger? Now, I think that's a good argument, and I think the skeptics like Hume do make this mistake, as if to psychologically in people's mind pit our belief or what we believe in against what everybody believes against science. You kind of see that in the popular mood today, what Christians believe versus what we all now know, like the law of gravity. As if when the apple fell into Newton's hands, that was something that Christians always said that actually like caused him to question his Christian faith. So you have this idea, you have these general sort of uncritically accepted ideas. I don't think that's what Hume's saying, not at this point. Hume has something specific in mind. By pitting the weaker evidence of a miracle against the stronger evidence of our senses. Hume is matching up the real contradictory theses. So, for example, this is a statement, and there's going to be an A, and there's going to be a non-A. Statement A, some dead man rose again to life. Now, the contradiction to that would be, no dead men rise again to life. So you have a type I statement in the square of opposition. Here's the square of opposition. All S is P, no S is P, some S is P, some S is not P. So the contradiction would be the I and the E statement. Some man rose from the grave would be the I statement. The contradiction to that would be no men rise from the grave. Dead men don't rise. One dead man did rise. More dead men might rise. But let's just start here. Some man rose from the dead. The contradictory thesis would be no dead men rise again to life. Now, if no dead men come to life, would that be a contradiction? Yes. But what if I say in general, no dead men, as a normal rule, dead men don't typically rise from the grave. Now, that's a scientific statement, because there I have a general principle, but it stays in its cage and it's aware of the problem of induction. As a general rule, dead men don't rise. I can confirm that as a scientific generalization. But if I confuse science with logic, and I say all swans are white, what do I need? And so that's Hume's problem of induction, which he's going to ignore when he comes to criticize miracles. So here's, again, the walking contradiction. Some are harder to see, because when he gets over here to this part of the book, you may have forgotten that part of the book. In that part of the book, he gave you the problem of induction. But in this part of the book, he's going to criticize miracles and hope that you will forget that you cannot confuse this type E statement as a scientific generalization as opposed to a logical necessity statement that it is impossible for men. It is a contradiction in terms for any man to rise from the grave. Well, once again, C.S. Lewis was on Hume's fallacies like white on rice. In his book, Miracles, Lewis explains how Hume has already cut off the branch that he's sitting on. It's an extended quote, but this is one of the reasons why it was so easy for me to become a Christian in this sense. Now, God used things like this. I always tell people that when you say, you know, how did you become a Christian? You start citing some books or some conversations. That is no more problematic than that God, you know, give you a particular scripture. Either way, the Holy Spirit does it. So, a little footnote there when I say things like that. it's no more easy for me to become a Christian than anybody else. It's impossible as a general statement. Right? So here's how Lewis says this. But yeah, I read things like this, and I was like, oh, this is why I love Lewis. This stuff like it. Quote, ever since Hume's famous essay, it has been believed that historical statements about miracles are the most intrinsically improbable of all historical statements. According to Hume, probability rests on what may be called the majority vote of our past experiences. Stop right there. Remember what Lewis had already done to expose Hume? Remember the problem with the uniformity of nature based on our experience. And then from the uniformity of nature, he's going to derive probability. But of course, since experience was already shot down, can we argue that our experience is at least probable? No, because probability was based on the uniformity of nature, which is based on experience. And so he showed that Hume is arguing in a circle. And it's a broken circle because this is already blown up, like a condemned building. And so Lewis pointed out, well, have that in your mind as you see this problem. Because really, it's going to be inside the same square circle house. So he says, according to Hume, probability rests on what may be called the majority vote of our past experiences. The more often a thing has been known to happen, the more probable it is that it should happen again. And the less often, the less probable. Now, the regularity of nature's course, says Hume, is supported by something better than the majority vote of past experiences. It is supported by their unanimous vote, or as Hume says, by firm and unalterable experience. There is, in fact, uniform experience against miracle. Otherwise, says Hume, it would not be a miracle. A miracle is therefore the most improbable of all events. It is always more probable that the witnesses were lying or mistaken, and the miracle occurred. Now, of course, we must agree with Hume that if there is absolutely uniform experience against miracles, if, in other words, they have never happened, why then they never have. Unfortunately, we know the experience against them to be uniform only if we know that all reports of them are false. And we know all the reports to be false only if we know already that miracles have never occurred. In fact, we are arguing in a circle. Do you hear what Lewis just said? Mr. Hume, what do you think of miracles? Oh, they've never happened. Well, how do you know they've never happened? Well, because there's a fixed and unalterable experience against them. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, I mean that there's uniform testimony against miracles. No one's ever seen one. Well, this guy over there says he did see one. Well, we don't have to look at that. Well, why don't you have to look at that? Well, because we know that... And he doesn't see it. Okay? So, Lewis's closing statement exposes the whole board of Hume's deception. Quote, "The question, do miracles occur? And the question, is the course of nature absolutely uniform? Are the same question asked in two different ways." So let me write on the board the new problem of the new kind of circle that Hume is making in the same house. Lewis is going to start by saying, Hume has asked two questions at different parts of the book. He's going to make you forget that they're the same question. Now the question, do miracles occur, is going to be a small circle inside the larger circle of the uniformity of nature that Hume has already dealt with unsuccessfully. So here's a question. The question, do miracles occur? And the question, so now I'm going to draw a bigger circle that this is inside of, because of course miracles are claimed to happen inside nature. I think it's a fair representation. Big circle, is nature absolutely uniform? Come on. Oh my goodness. I knew I was doing something wrong. LOL. TMI. Okay, is nature absolutely uniform? Okay, so let's listen again to Lewis so you can see it. The question, do miracles occur? And the question, is the course of nature absolutely uniform? Are the same question asked in two ways. Let me put an A over here, type A statement. Let me put an I over here. Here's why. Because here I'm saying all nature is uniform. Here I'm talking about the things that you're claiming to be miracles inside of that nature, and I'm saying some nature, that particular nature, that's still part of the same interlocking cause and effect. You see, a definition of a miracle to these people is a violation of the laws of nature. Or in other words, a violation of the uniformity of nature. That's what a miracle is, right, you Christians? So there's a type A statement and a type I statement inside of that. So, these two questions, Lewis says, are the same question asked in two different ways. I would say on two different planes in the same thing called nature. Hume, Lewis says, by sleight of hand, treats them as two different questions. He first answers yes as to the question of whether nature is absolutely uniform, and then he uses this yes as a ground for answering no to the question, do miracles occur? The single real question which he set out to answer is never discussed at all. In fact, he says, you don't bother, because it's yes. He gets the answer to one form of the question by assuming the answer to the other form of the same question. So why do miracles never occur? Because, okay, so he's using, this is what Lewis means by this is a grounding for this. We don't have to look at the evidence for miracles because they never exist. Why do they never exist? Because everything is uniform. Okay. Now, let's leave aside the fact that this is already a self-contradiction, and we looked at that two times ago, or maybe that was last time. Okay. So you see what Lewis is saying. A good Christian apologist like Lewis is to a skeptic like Hume what that clever kid is to the poor rent-a-magician at a birthday party. He's always saying things like, no, he's got it hidden under his sleeve. No, it's in his hat. No, he's got it. And he's the magician's worst nightmare if he's a bad magician. And that's all Hume was. He was the English-speaking world's best rented magician. The argument against miracles is that we need not look at the evidence. Why not? Well, it's because we know that no one has ever seen one. But Mr. Hume, some have claimed to have seen one. And so on in a circle that Hume hopes to make a big enough circle that you are no longer aware that you are actually following him in a circle. It's like running around in circles in one of those pumpkin patches that turns out to actually be crop circle or something. I don't know. I'm reaching for analogies here. What Hume's doing here is having you follow him in that circle, hopefully big enough over the course of nature that you forget or you never quite see that this is really the same question. And this has already been undercut, but it's his reason for this one. Okay? That's why you should read Lewis's nonfiction stuff if you haven't. It's good stuff. All right, against providence. Now we get easier, but just to show some of what's going on here, the implications. Remember that the problem of evil implies the incoherence of providence. Right? If a good God, an all-wise God, an all-powerful God, and yet you have evil, what about providence? Well, it depends on what your conception of providence is. So back to those dialogues concerning natural religion. Cleanthes, remember, he's the religious rationalist. He's the one that's going to do apologetics. Cleanthes counters that his two friends should take a good look around the world. And this is what Cleanthes says. So this is Hume's idea of what somebody would have in mind by the design argument. Quote, "You will find the world to be one great machine, subdivided into an infinite number of lesser machines, which again admit of subdivisions to a degree beyond what human senses and faculties can trace and explain. The curious adapting of means to ends throughout all nature resembles exactly, though it much exceeds, the productions of human contrivance, of human design, thought, wisdom, and intelligence. Since, therefore, the effects resemble each other, we are led to infer, by all the rules of analogy, that the causes also resemble, and that the author of nature is somewhat similar to the mind of man, though possessed of much larger faculties, proportioned to the grandeur of the work which he has executed. By this argument, a posteriori, from experience, and by this argument alone, do we prove at once the existence of a deity and his similarity to human mind and intelligence." Now, if that is Hume's conception of the teleological argument, then no wonder Hume rejected it. You have several problems. But this was the inductive design argument before Paley's watchmaker. Now, I'm going to go into detailed analysis of Hume's conception of the traditional arguments next week. But let's just show you what happens to Christian theology under this conception. This was the inductive design argument before Paley's watchmaker. But might Hume's designer be nothing more than a straw man? I mean, there is no doubt that certain evidential apologetics or apologists have argued from a one-to-one correspondence between the quality of the effect and the likeness of the cause. You see what Hume says, that these things resemble exactly what the big designer must be like. By the rules of analogy, these things resemble each other. God must be just like that, except like times infinity. Okay, so the one-to-one correspondence between the quality in the effect, its design, and the likeness of the cause. But must this be the only kind of teleological argument? Again, I'm going to say more about design and Hume's conception of natural theology in our final session. But for now, we bring it in only to assess his critique of divine providence. He returns us to his argument against the necessary connection between causes and effects. He attempts to show that by the principle of sufficient reason, which, by the way, is that every cause has to have the power or the sufficient power to explain its effect. An effect can't come from a cause that doesn't have at least the same amount of being and the same amount of attributes as the effect that it caused. Okay, so there has to be some kind of likeness there. Hume shows, he borrows from that principle of sufficient reason to show that all you need in any effect is just that amount. All that is necessary is to allow that the effect must have been caused by something with like power. But presumably the Christian God has all of that power and more. And so it is misleading for Christian apologists, it is misleading for speculative dogmatists to appeal to a law of causality and to appeal to a law of sufficient reason for the divine nature. Because all you need to produce corn is seed. All you need to produce that chair is a chair maker in plastic and a couple screws. So you see what he's saying. And of course, this is very simplistic. Even in Darwin's day, seed, what is that? On a molecular level. So it's a simplistic idea to begin with. But observe how he states this logic. He says, quote, "If the cause be known only by the effect," red flag, "if the cause be known only by the effect in the singular," red flag, "if the cause be known only by the effect, we never ought to ascribe to it any qualities beyond what are precisely requisite to produce the effect." So, notice Hume defines the terms up front. And by the way, if you define the terms of the debate, you pretty much win the debate. You define the language. That was Orwell's insight. So, Hume sets up the rules up front. If the cause be known only by the effect, singular, particular. So let me draw a board, last board of the day. I'm going to put on this board three things. Number one, I'm going to put the effect, the particular, singular effect. So I'll call it the effect in question. That's the first thing I'm going to put on the board because it's the only thing that Hume leaves standing. Because here, Hume is going to rule out two things that you actually need and that a full Christian theology would affirm. Two things that are off the table. Number one, the full range of relevant effects. So down here, you're going to have a posteriori. In other words, truth, insight, whatever, after experience. Up here, you're going to have a priori. Second thing he rules off the table up front is the nature of necessity, a priori, the way things must be, regardless of the effects, the thing from which the nature of the effects derive their intelligibility. Now, no doubt, Hume and his apologists are going to reply at this point that Hume's already dispensed with necessity. So there's two things. So from necessity, from the cause, everything else in the world exists. Hume is eliminating this, necessity a priori, and he's eliminating the full range of effects a posteriori, and he's only leaving our knowledge of the cause in one thing, and one thing only, he says, the particular effect. Okay, so little sleight of hand, very clever. Okay, we know, I'll speak for you Christians, what you mean in all of your apologetics, in all of your theology, is this cause, this thing, this God, this designer, this being, that you know only by the effect. Now, we've already demonstrated that Hume accomplished no such thing. He did not dispense with necessity. He contradicted himself. He did not dispense with intelligibility and order and things in the world. He accomplished none of that. He is simply assuming up front that this is what we mean, and he's assuming to eliminate things that he's not eliminated. Now, why am I going into this if I'm going to get into natural theology next week? Here's why. Here's what's accomplished. Just as with the freedom of the will, so with the system of nature. Hume is clearing the field of anything divine which may press in on us and which may cause us to think only one way about God. So anything authoritatively transcendent and anything authoritatively systematic is judged to be irrational. In other words, anything about God that actually, you know, lays a claim on everything of me. That's the upshot. Providence is to the world around me what dogma is to my mind. Providence is to free will what dogma is to free thought. I must eliminate providence for the same reason that I must eliminate dogma. I must eliminate providence for the sake of free will in the same way that I must eliminate dogma for the sake of free thought. These, providence and dogma, represent those last medieval mists that Hume's natural religion is sworn to clear away. Now, Hume says that he does not deny that God may have set up a general government of the world in which good behavior is generally rewarded and in which bad behavior is generally punished. If you work hard, you get certain results. If you sit on the couch and eat potato chips, you tend to be unemployed and stuff like that. Hume's not denying that. Now, you want to call that providence. This is true in general. And yet, you can believe in such expectations apart from the direct personal judicial hand that providence seems to imply. If you accept the traditional doctrine of providence, then Hume says, quote, I ought to expect some more particular reward of the good and the punishment of the bad beyond ordinary course of events. In other words, if providence were true, then not only would it be true that playing video games and eating potato chips doesn't go together with getting a paycheck and working hard and so on gets you a paycheck, not only would that be true, but evil people would get busted every time. Okay, so you see what he's saying? I would expect some more particular reward of the good and particular punishment of the bad beyond the ordinary course of events. Now, if Hume would have only read Augustine in the City of God in the early going, Augustine dealt comprehensively as to why God does what he does for his own glory and the good of the saints. Hume seems defiantly unaware of Augustine's argument of why God's providence does exactly what it does. But the argument here by Hume is simply that there ought to be full and final justice in each execution of justice. Or else, the link between providence and God's goodness breaks down. By the way, Hume's complaint against revealed religion is the same as Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, who I'm going to get to this week, their positive presentation of their theology. But again, this rests on the assumption which made up Hume's problem of evil. And with that problem exposed as self-contradictory, this premise is annihilated. And if this premise is annihilated, Hume's criterion against any particular providence falls to the ground too. So in conclusion, it should be acknowledged that Hume would agree with the conservative embrace of his brand of religion and philosophy. For all he meant to do, all I mean to do, said David Hume, is to take religion back out from under the speculation of philosophers run wild in the modern church. Now, I can allow, if I want to be charitable on a particular day, I can allow that Hume may have thought that this is what he was charged to do. But I do not have to allow that his intentions are sufficient to erase the laws of unintended consequences. Because Hume's philosophical theology, which is no theology or philosophy at all, his natural religion, just does have all of these effects. In his letter from a gentleman to his friend in Edinburgh, defending himself after he was turned down for the university position, Hume claimed that the bulk of his criticisms against natural theology were only attack against the sort of arguments being made by guys like Samuel Clarke, who seemed to ascribe a rationalist-like mathematical certainty to the whole set of traditional proofs. Because of the possibility of this restriction of Hume's skepticism, we're going to have to spend one more session in assessing Hume on natural theology, its true character, its scope, and its inevitable consequences. And I want to challenge you again, when you hear the next one, ask yourself again about Hume. Remember, Hume, the most sharp-speared atheist at the top of the stairs. The one guy that Christians should expect to sound least like. Challenge yourself. Where have I heard this before? As I'm hearing Hume, where have I heard this before in the church? That's what we'll look at next time. Questions, comments, or anything else?
Well, it's very fascinating that right there in your closing, talking about what were his motives and unintended consequences.
Yeah.
But one of his arguments is the singular effect tells all about the source.
Right.
And so the effects that he causes actually show that that was his intent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're being generous.
Yeah, I'm trying to be generous more to Russell Kirk and those types than to Hume himself. Also, you know, even if we accept that, but again, not to read his intents either, but what would a neo-Anglican conservative like Russell Kirk and others have to gain who are neither Roman Catholic nor Reformed? Well, what has Anglican theology always attempted to do? It's tried to steer this middle course between Rome and the Reformation because they're too dogmatic. Where have I heard that? The emergent church. Well, where have I heard that, a more conservative version of that? In emerging missional, and we're right back to our own circles where this is pressing in on us.
Are you certain of that?
Am I certain of that? No. But I am.
Doesn't it seem, though, if it's, you know, I'm skeptical of this, shouldn't you be skeptical of your conclusions then, too? I mean, as a pure skeptic,
right?
People should. So you would have to be omniscient in order to lay claim to any absolute that, oh, nature is uniform, right? Mm-hmm. We know this. We know there's no... You would have to be omniscient.
Right.
And so Hume is what? Is he claiming he's omniscient?
No, I think in the halls of philosophy, he sees that, he knows that, and then he wipes his hands clean of it, and I think he comes out at the end of the day sort of as the self-proclaimed victor, everybody's head spinning about all these things, and at the end of the day, his argument is similar to a lot of arguments I've heard in and out of the church against philosophy and against systematic theology, that, well, in the real world, it's just sort of this person with the biggest paycheck that just is to say, look, people like you are never going to get out of bed in the morning because you're asking why this and is the floor really there and it's like that. And at the end of the day, he's going to appeal to nature. He said, look, at the end of the day, this is here and it's always been here and this has always been this way. I mean, at that point, Hume is a tribalist. Hume is like a witch doctor, not even, the chief. He's more the chief guy, like Ayn Rand's Attila and the witch doctor. He's more like Attila, just saying, look, just stop asking questions. Look, I've been the best at asking these questions, and there's no answers, so says I, and so let's just, you know, this is wood.
Well,
I think that's his argument.
His argument against the providence, well, if, you know, shouldn't there be, like, extra special reward for doing the good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't sit on your butt and play video games, you shouldn't just get a paycheck for working hard, but there shouldn't we see this reward and this punishment of the two opposites? But you would have to be omniscient to say that there is no punishment for the opposite.
Right.
And then I was thinking two verses in Proverbs 16:4, the Lord works everything for its own ends, even the wicked for the day of disaster.
Right, right.
Well, have you seen all days?
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe there is still a day of disaster that you haven't seen.
Right.
And then the very next verse, the Lord abhors every arrogant person. Rest assured that they will not go unpunished.
Right.
So, I mean, you could read Augustine, you know, I guess the City of God and all that, where you could read some few chapters out of Proverbs and catch some of the same, logical arguments.
Right, exactly, and that's the thing, and that's why Augustine does use a bunch of scripture as he's using that, and that's what you did. As you were reading the Proverbs, you didn't just read it, because my first thought was, well, Hume will say, but I've already gotten rid of that book. Which he hasn't, but that's what he'll say, and that's what he's taught people to say. But you didn't just read the scripture. You said, have you seen the day of trouble?
Yeah.
Have you seen? So, same kind of questions God asks Job at the end.
Right.
So you do see apologetics even in the scriptures.
Right.
So you see the scripture and you say, okay, I dare you, Hume, to show me how Proverbs 16:4 is incoherent.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been in the future?
Yeah.
Because if you have to have that very omniscience that you're denying to God.
We know that nature is uniform. Oh yeah, were you there when nature began?
Right.
When I stretched out the heavens?
Yeah.
When I set the boundaries for the water?
And are you at the expanse of heavens now? Are you at the expanse of space? So.
Moderns always fall back, our postmoderns, on the certain, I can't be sure of things.
Mm-hmm.
They act like this is unassailable.
Agnosticism and atheism are like the good cop, bad cop, schizophrenic voice in everybody's head.
Yeah.
Right? As soon as the atheism doesn't work, you fall back and, well, none of us really know. And as soon as we soften up our thing, well, see, and then we go back to Dawkins. So we either have the British Dawkins accent, or we have the, I don't know, some hippie.
Yeah.
It's like these sock puppets in our brain.
Kurt does the same thing that says there's this whole realm that you can't know anything.
Right.
To tell you that you can't know.
But trust me, because I'm omniscient.
Right.
I mean, it's basically...